My name's Rex Jury. I'm a member of the Press Club Board. I'm standing in today for our chairman, Grant Hedding, who rang this morning from Queensland, where he's holidaying on the beach, so we have no sympathy for him at all. It'll be my duty later in the lunch to introduce our guest speaker, Mr. Peter Costello, but I would like to initially welcome you all to this lunch. A nice crowd, nice to see you, and particularly I'd like to welcome those of you who are here for the first time. There's a lot of familiar faces here, as there always are. I see a man who last time I saw him didn't have a beard and now has got one. We won't go there, Russell, will we? I'd also formally like to welcome two federal members, Andrew Southcott and Senator Simon Birmingham, and locally the Leader of the Opposition, Martin Hamilton-Smith, and the member for Shubert, Ivan Venning. If you're here, Ivan, somewhere, I'm told you are. There he is. I'd also like to welcome Colette Smith from Telstra and Henry Mertz, a new face in our room, a partner with Deloitte. Deloitte is a next-door neighbour to the advertiser physically, so it's nice to have you along, Henry. Jeff Timms from Timms Manufacturing Jewellers, good supporters of ours, and the coincidentally named Robbie Cooter Timms from SA Brewing, so it's in the family, their generosity. Nice to see you, Robbie. I saw you on your way in. After the meal, of course, and it's about to be served, we'll hear from our guest, Peter Costello. I particularly want to acknowledge, though, Telstra. They've been terrific supporters of ours. Also, Pernod Ricard. I haven't yet had a drink. Mr. Costello had a Coke, and I haven't had a drink, but I'm going to set that straight any minute, I can assure you, and Pernod Ricard are going to help me do that. Could I urge you, please, on your table, you'll have a raffle book. I think they're $3 for $5, or they are now. We try to keep our prices down for lunches here, and we try to make out we're a non-profit organisation, and often it's the raffles that turn a loss into profit at these lunches, so please feel a little bit generous if you wouldn't mind. We've over the years, since Don Riddell, who's here, our initial president and driving force behind the establishment of the Press Club, we've built up a reasonable surplus. I think Mr. Costello would be pleased with that. In fact, last year at a board meeting, I suggested we put it into shares, and I was overruled. I don't know how I've stayed on the board, quite frankly. But the prizes for the raffle include a 300. I think the main one is Telstra's cordless phone. Carton of beer, $300 voucher from Timms Manufacturing, fantastic. CDs, courtesy of 5AA, SA Brewing as always. But please put your hand in your pocket and buy a ticket. After our guest speaker has given his oration today, there will be an opportunity for people to ask questions. We quite properly, I think, favour the working media, but anyone who wants to register can do so at Joanna at the back of the room. Just register that you would like to ask a question. As I say, we favour the working media initially, but everyone gets a go if the steam runs out. So please enjoy your lunch, and I'll come back a little later and welcome our guest speaker. Thank you. Terrific. A good lunch, and I think it's going to get better. We've had a serious debate, which we've had to cut across because it's Peter's turn to speak, but we've had a long discussion about the Essendon Football Club, and that's serious stuff, don't go. Hey, come on. There are things like the economy, and there's things like the Essendon Football Club, and It's my pleasure, as I said, in the absence of Grant, who's in his togs up on the beach, to introduce our guest speaker today, the former Coalition Treasurer, Peter Costello. A year or two ago, I was in this position and I introduced George Negus. And I said that George is one of those people that doesn't really need an introduction, and then I outlined his career and said what a good bloke he was. And when he got up, he said, "How come if I didn't need an introduction that you wasted 5 minutes talking about me?" So I'm not going to waste 5 minutes talking about Peter Costello, because he's another one of these people who needs no introduction. In fact, he's probably better known than George Negus. And in fact, probably in the last 12 years, he's been on television more than George Negus. Just gets paid less, that's all. But we all know that Peter Costello is a lawyer. He entered the federal parliament in Victorian seat of Higgins in 1990 and served as federal treasurer for a record 11 years. And I'll bet no one can name the treasurer before him, but I'll let you think about that yourself. In fact, I doubt that Peter can. 11 years is a long time to be treasurer, but I noted that David Barnett, in a review of Peter's book, written in the Canberra Times, said, "Costello quickly got to the top and stayed there as treasurer for 1,112 years. I don't know why that literal appeared, but I suppose, Peter, at some time you thought it was that long. I'm going to contain my remarks to five things you may not know about Peter Costello. The first is that in his head he has a gold tooth and the wag of a dentist inscribed the letters GST on it. So I think anyone who buys a book may get a glimpse of it. You don't get a glimpse of it without buying a book, and they'll be available immediately after Peter's spoken here today. The second is that in his early days in politics, Peter was closely aligned with the Labor Party. And in fact, I understand that the records of the Balaclava branch in Victoria of the Labor Party may even claim that Peter Costello was on their membership list. He may wish to speak about that, he may wish to deny it, I don't know. Peter's rise to political prominence began in 1977 when he was punched in the nose. He was at a political meeting and an adversary snotted him, and the publicity that followed lifted Peter Costello's profile in the eyes of both parties. And it was a bit like Trade Week, which is just finishing, by the way. It's a bit like Trade Week. It seems that the Liberals got him, not the Labor Party. The fourth thing I want to tell you about Peter Costello is that in his Facebook he has 183 friends. I'd suggest if you had that many friends in the parliamentary party, you might have been Prime Minister today, but that's quite another story. And finally, I googled Peter Costello hobbies, and there, in his own words, were his hobbies. He said that he likes AFL football, and of course that is all hung on the Mighty Bombers, and he likes cooking barbecues. No wonder you're not leaving politics if that's all you do. But it was a wet winter. It wasn't a barbecue winter in Melbourne, and so Peter was driven indoors, and during that time he wrote a book. To tell you about the book and the gold tooth, Peter Costello.
Well, thank you very much, Rex. And I think after that introduction, all I need to do is give the vote of thanks, and we can all go off and have fun. Speaking of being well known, after I ceased being treasurer, I had to start driving my own car again, which I hadn't done for a long period of time. And I tried to start it. I went home, tried to start it, and the battery was flat. So I decided to ring up the what's called the RACV, the Auto Club in Victoria. And it was a 1-800 number, and the phone was answered somewhere between here and Bangalore. And they asked for the registration, and I gave the registration number, and they said model, and I said, oh, it's a Holden. They said, name of the registered owner, and I said, Costello. Christian name for the registered owner, I said, Peter. This voice said, oh, Peter Costello, oh, you've got the same name as the Australian Treasurer. And I said, yes. And then this person said, oh, well, I bet everyone tells you that. I said, you would not believe how many people tell me I've got the same name as the Australian Treasurer. And finally, someone came around to fix the battery. And in return for an autograph, I got a new battery. So how about that? But in return for an autograph, there are no free books today, just in case you were wondering. Can I acknowledge Senator Birmingham, Dr. Southcott and Martin, who was very rude when Rex said that there were important things like the Essendon Football Club and non-important things like the economy. Martin Hamlin-Smith said they're both in free fall, so... Speak for yourself. During the 2007 election campaign, which is really just a year ago, I said that economic management would be a key issue of the campaign. I said Australia would be facing challenges in the future, and one of them would be a financial tsunami. The idea was that in a tsunami there's an epicentre, a quake which moves the waves, and I said the waves would spread outwards and they would cause damage to countries around the world. The opposition ridiculed this claim. They said it was a tsunami of distraction. Costello was trying to scare people into voting for the coalition. I was certainly trying to get people to vote for the coalition. But as I look back, probably I didn't scare enough. Perhaps I should have gone harder in my warnings as we look at what is now taking place around the world. And it's very interesting for me to think back a year ago, the 2007 election campaign was really fought on the basis that the Australian economy was rock solid, strong and prosperous economic times would last forever, and the big issues, in fact, in that election were not economic at all. Big issues in that election included things like climate change. Big issues in the election were more the social issues than the economic ones. And the funny thing is, as I've listened to the commentary that's been going on in recent weeks, nobody seems to be talking about climate change at the moment. And what it illustrates to me is when you're confident about the economy and your economic prospects, obviously your attention, your concern turns to other issues. But when your job's on the line or your superannuation's on the line or your house is on the line or the loan is on the line, it tends to put everything else back into perspective again. It's a hierarchy of issues. And if you were to poll the Australian public today on the issues of most importance to them, number one's the economy. In fact, there isn't any other issue. But as little as a year ago, during the 2007 election campaign, the economy was falling. Climate change was up there. Reconciliation issues was up there. Health was up there. And I only introduce what I'm going to say today saying that by reminding people that the focus of politics and the focus of national attention and national conversation can change very, very quickly. And we've watched it change over the last 12 months. If the federal election were being held now against the backdrop of economic developments it could have come out differently. But as with life in politics, timing is everything. And I'm not complaining before some scribe says, oh, Costello's complaining that they lost the election. I'm not complaining that we lost the election. The election was due and you find it on the issues at the time. My point is that the public's memory and the public's focus changes, rightly changes. And with it, the national conversation changes. I had one of those life-changing episodes during that campaign in 2007 when I went to the local primary school in my electorate, the Ashburton Primary School, to open a new school playground. And the principal assembled 300 kids in the school gymnasium. And their mothers were invited, so the mothers were standing around the walls. And the teachers were there, and they were sitting up on the platform. And because I was there, and it was a federal election campaign, the TV cameras from every media outlet in the country were there, and I was being trailed by the Fairfax and the news journalists and radio. And the principal had got a representative of each class to get up and ask me a question. So they started off with grade six, and the first one stood up and he said, Mr. Costello, if you're re-elected, will our school get more computers? Oh, yes, I said, of course. I have a policy in relation to school computers. Somebody said, Mr. Costello, if you're re-elected, will we get a new playground? Oh, well, I'm just opening a new one now, I said, but there's always room for more, of course. Next question, grade four. Mr. Costello, what football team do you barrack for? Why, I barrack for the Mighty Bombers, I said. Ray! Some of the kids shout, boo, say most of the kids. We go down the years, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We get to the prep class. And this cute little kid walked out in front of the whole school, the teachers, the mothers, and the press of Australia. And he said, Mr. Costello, my name's Rourke. And I have a question. Who made cactuses? Well, I'd fielded questions from Kerry O'Brien and Laurie Oakes, but Rourke Sheridan took it out that day. And the next morning, the Sydney Morning Herald publishes this banner headline, Are You Cactus, Mr. Costello? Won a Walkley Award, and Rourke became a household name for 24 hours here in Australia. And when I began writing my book, I had Rourke very much on my mind, going cactus in the 2007 election campaign. I posed this question, how did a government that had created an age of prosperity, a proud and prosperous country, now find itself in the wilderness? And that's the question that I set out to answer in my book. After that economic record, and I'm very confident of the economic record, I'll stack this period of 11 years up against any other period of 11 years in Australia's economic history. And yet at the end of it, we were voted out of office in November of 2007. I actually think we weren't voted out because the economy was bad. I think we were voted out because it was good. That people thought that there was no risk in changing government, that their jobs weren't going to be at stake, that their mortgages weren't going to be at stake, that they could change the government without any great risk. And that a fresh face would give the government the opportunity to modernise, deal with some of the social issues which people felt were becoming more important. And I said to my colleagues, we can either change ourselves, we give the electorate some change, or they'll give us some change. We didn't change, so they gave us change, voting the government out and in fact voting John Howard out in his own seat. Only the second Prime Minister in Australia's history to be voted out in his own parliamentary seat. And I think it's because we, the Liberal Party, failed to renew. We didn't deal with succession planning and leadership transition. Now, those of you who are involved in business know that succession planning is absolutely critical to the health of a business. A business that wants to go on past one generation of its management knows that it has to plan for the future and organise for the future. You know you've got to do that in business. You know you've got to do that in partnerships. You know you've got to do that in hospitals and schools and newspapers and football teams. You should always be thinking about the next generation of leadership, but we in the Liberal Party let that issue slip. It wasn't that we didn't discuss it. We discussed it on many, many occasions, just that every one of those discussions ended in no change. And here's a lesson for Conservatives. Quite often Conservatives think if you keep things as they are, there'll be no change. But you see, the world has changed. Everything's changing in the world all the time. Sometimes to maintain the best, you have to adapt to change. You've got to adapt to change to preserve those things that are absolutely important. And we as a political party didn't manage to do that. Rex is a great devotee of the Essendon Football Club, as am I. And I remember at the beginning of the 2006 football season, the Essendon Football Club said, James Hurd's going to retire this year, 2006. We want to have a testimonial. Will you give a speech? And I said, oh, sure, it's a great honour. Going to give a farewell speech to Hurdy, and it'll be at the end of the season. Gearing myself up all year, getting a bit toey about this speech that I've got to go and give. And at the end of the season, on the Saturday before we're going to have this farewell to James Hurd announced that he's going to play on for another year. So I rang up the club and I said, we're having this farewell for James Hurd and he's not going. And what do we do? And they said, well, we've got 1,000 people coming. We've got a farewell, even though he's playing on. So I go to this dinner. We've got 1,000 people there for James Hurd's farewell. And I get up and I say, well, I'm here to give a farewell speech to James, who's not retiring. And I said, I wonder where I've come across this before. James started laughing and I looked at James and I said, what is it about the initials JH? Anyway, he played on for another year and we didn't go so well. And we played on for another election and we didn't go so well in November of 2007. But I think there is a lesson there. It's a big lesson for the Liberal Party, and for our side of politics, that you've got to invest in people. You've got to invest in the future. And it's absolutely essential in political parties that you're anticipating events and how they will develop. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, because I wanted to actually tell the story of the government from the inside. There are only three people who were in our government from day one to day zero. They were John Howard, who was the leader of the Liberal Party and Prime Minister, myself as the Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party and Treasurer, and Alexander Downer, the Foreign Minister. We were there on day one in March of 1996. We were there on the 24th of November 2007. And it was an extraordinarily long period of stable government. So long that Howard became the second longest serving Prime Minister in Australia's history. Downer became the longest serving Foreign Minister in Australian history, and I became the longest serving Treasurer in Australian history, delivering 12 budgets, more than anybody else in Australian history. In fact, 10% of the federal budgets in the whole of Australia's history were delivered by me, which doesn't show you how good I was, because if I'd been any good, they would have promoted me. But it shows you how long I was actually there. But I think some of the lessons that we learnt in that period have been absolutely essential to some of the challenges that Australia is now going to face. in 1997, the whole of the East Asian region went into, first of all, financial collapse and then economic collapse. And it got so bad, for example, Korea ran out of reserves. The government of Korea went bankrupt in 1997. And they appealed to the public to start donating their gold jewellery to the government so it could replenish its reserves. Much more serious than any of the financial problems that current countries are in. And I'll never forget seeing footage of Koreans lining up outside government offices, taking off their rings and their jewellery, giving it to the government so it could rebuild gold reserves and refloat the economy. How would you like to see that? How would you like to see Australians lining up outside the tax office donating their gold rings to the Australian government? I don't think it would happen, but it did happen in Korea. And we learn a number of lessons from this. The first thing is you need well-capitalised, profitable financial institutions. You know, we all look at those bank profits and think to ourselves, isn't it awful that banks are making so much money? But I used to say when I was treasurer, there's only one thing worse than a profitable bank, and that's an unprofitable bank. You've heard the expression, if you owe the bank $100, you've got a problem. If you owe the bank $100 million, the bank's got a problem. And at a time like this, you want well-capitalised and profitable financial institutions. Secondly, we revamped the whole of Australia's financial regulation. We established a new body to regulate all of our financial institutions, the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, APRA, APRA. And so when you hear Mr Rudd and Mr Swadden say Australia's a well-regulated market, they're right. Much better than the United States. When you hear them say our banks are well-capitalised and profitable, they're right. Much better than financial institutions. They should go on and make another point, I think. Another big difference for Australia is our government has no debt. We paid off government debt and we cashed the Australian government up. The United States government has a debt which is equivalent to 50% of its GDP. If we had in this country a debt equivalent to 50% of our GDP, our government would have outstanding debt of about $500 to $600 billion. But we have no net debt. So the government doesn't have to raise funds. The Commonwealth government doesn't have to raise funds. It's very hard to raise funds at the moment. And the prices you're going to be paying to raise them are going to be quite high. But we don't have to, because we paid off debt. And we established a future fund to fund obligations into the future, which has been an incredibly important source of liquidity during this current financial malaise. So strong financial institutions, good regulation, no net debt will put Australia in a much stronger position than comparable countries around the world. With the US bailout that is going on at the moment, the US government has to borrow the money to bail out the banks. As I told you, it's already got a debt of 50% of GDP, $9.6 trillion. And it's out there trying to borrow more money at a time like this to fund a bailout package. Pity the poor US taxpayer. And the British government is the same. It's got a debt of about 50% to GDP. Now, I'm not saying that Australia can be totally immune, because as I said before last year's election, the waves of a tsunami lap the shores of everybody that abuts the financial system. But we'll go into this from a much stronger position. And Rudd and Swan are right to say we're better regulated and we have strong financial institutions, and they ought to go on and say we have no debt. And every now and then they might even think about how we got to that situation, which would be a worthy thing to do. But Australia today is much stronger than the Australia of the early 1990s. And we have valuable experience which we can actually offer. I noticed that this weekend the US Treasury Secretary is going to convene a meeting of the G20, the group of 20 countries important to the international financial architecture. We were involved in setting that up in 1997, and I, in fact, was the chairman of that group. We brought the conference to Melbourne in November of 2006. You might remember it. There were riots in the streets of Melbourne as the demonstrators came out to riot against the G20. Why, I don't know. Never really figured out why they had riots against the G20. Very important institution for discussing international global cooperation. Australia should be right at the centre of that because we were critical to setting it up, and in fact I was its longest serving member up until November 2007. And it does provide a seat at the table for Australia. And we ought to have a seat at the table. We're about the 13th largest economy in the world. 13th or 14th largest economy in the world. We ought to have a seat at the table because we've got valuable experience to offer and to give to other people. And when they look at Australia, the first thing foreigners say is, how do you get a country with no debt? No government debt? And it's valuable experience that we can share with others around the world. Now, a financial crisis will begin to feed into the real economy at some point. But if you can insulate yourself, you can insulate the effect on the real economy, which is absolutely critical for Australia at this point. And if we insulate and we come through this downturn, Australia will be stronger for it. We survived the US recession of 2000-2001. The US went into recession. We survived the financial collapse of 1997, and we're stronger today than we were in 97 and in 2001. And so, properly managed and well governed, and that's the critical thing, properly managed and well governed, Australia can come through this financial crisis. But that is the key thing, to be properly managed and well governed. And I want to underline that and put a highlighter pencil over it and put some asterisks. Properly managed and well governed, you know what I'm meaning. It can't be taken for granted. And if we do that, the Australian economy can come through strong because of the foundation that we've laid. And it's all very important for all of our sakes that we do come through stronger and better governed in the future. So in the account that I've given of 11 and a half years of economic policy making, I try and tell the economic story and something of the political story and something of the human story as well. Rex mentioned earlier my dental position. During the introduction of GST, and I feel I ought to really just get the story out because I'm not sure Rex told it as properly as he should have. He's a journalist. I had, fair cop, Rex. I had been grinding my teeth with all of this worry over the GST, and my dentist said, you need a gold crown. And I went to have it fitted, and as he went to put it in my mouth, he started laughing and laughing and laughing. And I just thought it was a dentist laughing at the pain that he was about to inflict on a patient. And he said, you know, if you ever die in a crash and we need to identify you from dental records, this is going to help. And then he showed me this gold crown. He said, I've had the letters GST engraved on it. So if you ever hear of an aircraft crash and they pull out the dental records and there's someone with a gold crown that has GST engraved, you know it's me. I don't think it's anybody else in Australia, but it's constantly with me, constantly reminding me of the pain of great reform, but also the benefits of great reform running this country's economy. Thank you all very much.
That applause was for your speech, not for me walking up on the stage. Peter's happy to ask or answer any questions. I see the Australian and the Advertiser are keen to get to the microphone. So would the working media please push their way forward and get ready for questions. And as you are, I've got two questions. The first is, where did cactuses come from? And will James Heard run for Higgins when you stand down?
Well, put it this way, I think James would do a better job in Higgins than I'd do on the Essendon Football Club team, Rex. And where did cactuses come from? I thought about it for a long time. I was absolutely stumped by the whole thing. And so I very weakly said at the end of the assembly, you know, I think God made everything. God made cactuses.
Yeah, that's a politician's answer. Could you give your name, please, and your organisation, and let's get stuck into the former Treasurer.
Hello, Verity Edwards from The Australian. I don't mean to hog the mic, but I have three questions. The first question is, should the heads of banks, and particularly the US banks, be held accountable for the financial crisis?
Oh, you want me to take them one by one?
Yes, please.
Okay, sure. Here's my analysis. Mortgage originators made loans to bad credit risks. So, people who had no capacity to repay their loans, who shouldn't have borrowed, and there were mortgage originators who knew that they had no capacity to repay, who made the loans. And these loans are what are called in the trade ninja loans. Ninja loans. No income, no job, no assets. You make a ninja loan to someone who's got no income, no job, no asset, and lo and behold, they default. What a surprise that is. But the mortgages are then on-sold, sometimes to banks, investment banks. Even in Australia, municipal councils were buying some of these instruments. Now, I think at the point they got on-sold, bankers should have known better. So I think the heads of those banks that have purchased a lot of these instruments, which are now worth nothing, should be held accountable. But I think the problem didn't originate in the banking system. The problem originated outside of the banking system with mortgage originators, which were completely unregulated in the United States, another weakness of their regulatory system.
My second question is, if they should be held accountable, should they face criminal sanctions?
Well, if they've broken the law, yes, of course they should. That's the answer.
Okay. And my third question, if you take, for example, Dick Fuld, the Lehman Brothers former director, he took home $440 million over several years. Should the heads of banks, such banks, including the US banks, should they be forced to repay some of that money or give back some of that money if they've gone into meltdown?
Well, you see, his remuneration package would have had to have been, I presume, approved. Well, in Australia, let me say, I can't say for certain about US law, but in Australia, we require remuneration packages to be put before a shareholders' meeting and approved by shareholders, because it's shareholders' money. And if some of that remuneration package, in my view, if it wasn't approved by the shareholders, It's the shareholders' money. The shareholders have got a valid claim on it. That's my view. The assets of a company, any company, don't belong to the management. They belong to the shareholders. Now, you'd have to... You asked me about... I think it was Lehman Brothers, that guy was... Yeah. I can't tell you the details about Lehman Brothers, but I'm sure that some enterprising lawyer in the United States will be looking at that question right now.
Mr. Costello, Daniela Retorto from Channel 10 News here in Adelaide. Just a quick question. Have you spoken to John Howard since the publication of your book?
Not since the publication, no.
Do you think he's got a copy?
I'm sure he has.
That's all. Thank you.
But only because so many millions of Australians do have a copy of the book. I think we've found the last couple of unsold copies over here.
Hi, Mr. Mike Maguire from The Advertiser. Given what you said about the need for well-capitalised, profitable banks, is it legitimate for the banks not to pass on a full 1% cut from the Reserve Bank?
Well, let me make this point. The Reserve Bank was raising interest rates in this country in February, March. Now, 6 months later, it's cutting them. When the Reserve Bank was raising rates, the banks weren't just raising, but they were raising by more than the Reserve Bank movements. And the banks, earlier this year, had already increased their margins over and above the official rate by more than 50 basis points. So they already increased their margin. Now that the banks cut them, the banks haven't passed the full amount on, they've increased their margin again. So that their margin above the official rate's probably about 75 basis points higher than when our government was in office. That is, today, on any given official rate, the banks are charging about 0.75%, 75 basis points more. So, you know, the point I would make is that the banks had already raised by 50 basis points. They've now just got another 20. And I made the point that when the Reserve Bank cuts rates, it's not for the benefit of banks, it's for the benefit of borrowers. It's to get it out there in the real economy. So having already increased their margins, I think they've done pretty well to increase them again.
So they're just gouging borrowers, are they?
Pardon?
They're just gouging borrowers?
Well, they're highly profitable institutions that are keeping their high profits going.
Just a second one. Given what you said about the benefits of experience and understanding how world economies work and so forth, are you not a better qualified person to lead the Liberal Party than Malcolm Turnbull?
Well, I thank you for your compliment. nobody ever complains when they are given a compliment, but I formed the view after the election that it was better for me to stand aside and to give somebody else their go. Brendan, a very decent man, had his go, it didn't work out, and Malcolm has now got his opportunity, has my full support.
Verity Edwards from The Australian again, but just one more banking question.
Hey, you had three last time.
Well, no one else is asking any questions, so I might as well give it my full go. Should the bank CEOs be paid normal salaries? And by normal, I'm happy to say $1, $2, $3 million, but...
Is that normal?
I don't know, but compared to 30 or 40 million, it's along the range of other CEOs.
Here's what I think, you know, who should in the end decide what a CEO's package should be? In my view, the shareholders. It's the shareholders' money. Now, The shareholders are prepared to authorise a very high package on the grounds that they think that will improve their share price. I'm not going to stand in their way. It's their money, it's their investment, they should make the decision. But I think it should go to the shareholders. I think shareholders should be very informed about it. I think they should focus on it. The laws that we put in place required this to be disclosed to the annual general meeting. And I think a lot of shareholders, I make this prediction, at the annual general meetings, which will be coming up shortly, I think a lot of shareholders will be looking very, very carefully at the remuneration packages in the light of how their shares are going. You know, maybe the shareholders were quite happy with these packages when they saw their shares going up and up. Maybe they'll be less happy as they're coming down and down and down. But I don't think it's for me to decide. I don't even think it's for the government to decide. I think it's for the shareholders to decide.
Hello, Alan Atkinson, ABC Television News. Mr. Costello, you made great play about the Liberal Party's need to renew itself, and that was something you gave great consideration to. You also knew John Howard for 10, 11, 12 years or longer. Why did you not challenge and challenge and challenge again?
Well, I thought the proper thing for me to do was to raise this with John Howard, which I did, man to man, very directly, on a number of occasions, which I write in the book. Why did I not resign from the government? Well, because I'm a loyal Liberal. I wanted the Liberal Party to win an election. I thought by resigning from the government, far from giving it the opportunity to win the election, it would damage the government. Now, you know, people will make up their own minds about that, but that's the way I felt. I write in my book that I was very involved in helping John Howard get to the leadership. I was the deputy leader. I helped him when he was not leader. I was the deputy leader. And I helped him get to the Liberal Party leadership unopposed. I thought it was good for him. I thought it was good for the party. And we won an election. I thought we should have done the same again. People say, well, why didn't you challenge, go to the backbench, tear the government down? And mostly the people who say that to me are Labor voters. And they say that because they would rather have me torn the government down, and I didn't think that was the right thing to do as its deputy leader.
I only ask that as...
I'm not being critical of the question. That's my answer.
I'm not a Labor voter. I asked
that... Don't tell the ABC that. You'll be looking for a job pretty shortly.
Well, actually, I do say that. No, I asked that on reflection, and because you've written a book about it, and you knew that he was a stubborn bastard, and you'd been there with him for 11 years. It strikes me, and possibly a lot of people, as odd that you knew what politics is all about, and that you if you wanted that job, you couldn't take it, and you knew the way to take it.
Well,
would be
the
to
only
go.
Way to take it was to beat him in a ballot. And no, I didn't know that I could have beaten him in ballot. I'm quite honest about this in my book. I say, certainly in 2006, I think he would have won a ballot. In 2007, John Howard considered standing down during the APEC meeting, about this time last year, September of 2007. We were only 2 months out from an election then, and... the whole thing came up again, what's now called the Key West meeting of cabinet ministers. Whether or not there was still a majority at that point, I'm not entirely sure, but it was only 2 months before an election then, and the cabinet took the view, and I took the view, that if there had been a putsch against John Howard at that point, we'd have ended up fighting the 2007 election on two fronts, one against the Labor Party and the other against John Howard. It was all too late by that stage.
Hi, I'm Susie Reichstein from the Schubert Electorate Office. I'm just wondering, if the result in November of last year had have been different and the Liberal government had been reinstated, What would be different now? In other words, how would you be dealing with the current global economic crisis?
Well, I think, as I say, you know, I want to be fair about this. I think Rudd and Swan are saying the right things when they're trying to give confidence about our financial institutions, confidence about our regulatory system, and they ought to make the point. They don't, because they can't do it for political reasons, but they ought to make the point that having freed Australia from debt has given us an enormous advantage. And by the way, if they made that point, this would add to confidence. I would say to them in their own interests, a little bit of bipartisan acknowledgement might go a long way in this situation. Also, of course, as I've said earlier, I think Australia would be capable of playing a much greater role in the G20 if people had more experience were still around. But the criticism I think I would make of Rudd is for political reasons, after the November election, Rudd tried to talk up inflation. See, it's very embarrassing to come to office and say, I've come to office, I've got a surplus budget, I've got no debt, I've got full employment. You've got to find a problem to fix, you see. So you come to office, got to find a problem. So what was the problem he found? Oh, inflation. Got a big inflation problem. So run around the country saying there's a big inflation problem. Okay, so what's the answer to a big inflation problem? Push up interest rates. Now, in the middle of a financial crisis, what's the answer to push interest rates down? As recently as 3 months ago, the government's running around saying we've got inflation, the prescription is interest rate rises. That wasn't a real problem. The real problem was the financial fallout, for which the prescription was the very opposite of what they spent their first 6 months talking about. And that's the criticism I'd make of them. Some journalist ought to stick a microphone up, Mr. Rudd, today and say, is inflation still a problem? I don't think it is. I think the problem we've got now is a real one. Now, we don't need manufactured problems because we actually have found a real one. And the prescription that they spent their first 6 months working on was the wrong prescription.
Two more questions. Peter Short, Barry.
Oh, thank you, Rex.
Peter, if I might be so familiar with his usual Christian name. I'm a director of various companies in South Australia, and one of them where we have industrial sites, we find necessary to borrow money and take mortgages out on them. We realise that if we default on those mortgages, we have to pay the difference to the sale price. Now, what I'm asking this for is because the average person, and I'm a bit below average, I suppose, doesn't really understand what's happening. In America, under those circumstances, if you default on a mortgage, you don't have to pay. But what most people can't understand is, firstly, why this have any effect on Australia, and secondly, why it has suddenly blossomed out to an incredible thing. You can understand that with every bank, some people would default on their mortgages. Every lending organisation would have some people default on their mortgages. But if we understand what the media tells us, everybody in the whole of America has defaulted on their mortgages and left this great debt. So could you explain that to us?
Well, the figures the US Treasury gave was they think there are 5 million mortgages that are either in default or delinquent in America. So 5 million is a pretty big number. It's not the total American mortgage market, obviously, but it's pretty big. So how does that radiate out? Well, in two ways, really. There are some Australian banks and institutions that actually hold some of these mortgages. So they've now suffered the default. But the second reason is that these bad loans, these toxic assets, are in various institutions, and nobody's quite sure which institutions or how much. And so the institutions are very wary about dealing with each other. You know, I deal with Lehman Brothers, respectable Wall Street firm. I make a loan to Lehman Brothers. And suddenly I find out it's got all of these toxic loans and it's disappeared from the face of the earth. Now I've got a bad debt, which Lehman Brothers is not going to pay back. Or I'm dealing with Bear Stearns, or I'm dealing with someone else. So now you've got the institutions themselves very wary about each other, not knowing, you know, it's almost like pass the parcel. Here's a parcel of bad, toxic debts, and it's going around the banks, and who's going to be caught with it? And who's going to be dealing with the person that's caught with it? And that's why you really got to get these toxic debts out of the system before people will have confidence in dealing with each other again. And that's basically what the rescue package is all about. So who's going to take the toxic debts in America? The taxpayer. That's what will happen. The taxpayer will take the toxic debts, which is pretty tough on the taxpayer, but if there's nobody else to do it, then that's what's required, that's what they'll do.
Thank you, Peter. I'm not so sure that you've answered the question, but thanks for trying.
No, I thought I did.
Denise Rutt, co-director of a private enterprise company here in South Australia. Firstly, I think you've answered my question, but I'd like to congratulate you, John Howard, and also Alexander Downer for placing the country in the position which you have done so today. My question is, of your opinion, do you feel that the present government is capable of managing the country under the present circumstances?
I think the present government could lift its game.
Thank you, Peter.
I think on a day when the markets... Yeah, I better not look at that. It might be secret stuff. On a day when the market drops another 7%, it's been a privilege for us all to have someone of the experience, the background... and the internal knowledge of Peter Costello to explain to us just some of the hurdles which we're yet to face and provide to us some of the solutions which we're going to have to adopt to get through the next, well, you give a period of time, a couple of years. Peter did not today dwell on his book. He told us gave us his perspective of the economy, the contemporary economy as he saw it. I'm going to dwell on his book for just a moment. I've had a glance at it. It's available over here. I understand that signed copies are worth less than the clean copy, but nonetheless, I saw the cartoon. But John Howard's got a clean copy, for example. Peter's been kind enough to come along here today and give us his experience and his understanding of the economy. The book's good. It's a good read about both the financial situation and the political situation in Australia, and particularly the Liberal Party. They're over here, and they are for sale. Don Riddell, could I call you up, please, to do two things? You haven't been on this stage for a while, but I would like you to present that empty box to Peter. having drunk Coca-Cola and orange juice all day. I've taken the bottle out of it. And also, Don, I'd like you to draw the raffle.
Piece of South
Australia I hope you take with you.
Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I think you've done it, but thank you, Peter Costello. Don, would you grow the raffle, please? This is Red E1. Red E1. Hey, come on up. This one's purple.
F-24. Forces man. Minter Ellis has written his name on it. T. Martin. F-24. Purple. Well done. Thank you very
much. How many more? Now this is a blue F-5.
Judith Leesmore, where's Judith? You won something, Judith. What's Judith won?
Orange E4. Oh, well done. Next one. This is fun doing a chook raffle. Must be a red E8. Come on up. This is the last one.
This last one.
Black A, 49. Samantha. Black A, 49. Samantha Gray. There you are. Thanks very much indeed. Thank you for the Press Club Chook Raffle. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes our lunch today. I'd like to thank again our speaker, Peter Costello. Thank you all for coming. I'd just like to remind you, if I could for a second, the Press Club, with its money, now has scholarships for young journalists. We give something like $5,000. We've got a terrific group of entries coming in now, and we're sending young journalists overseas to broaden their experience, and Michael Maguire doesn't become young. But thank you all for coming, and we'll see you at the next lunch. Thank you.